Okay, in this week's look at the book of Acts, we're going to be in chapter 18. And for several weeks, we've been following the Apostle Paul and the company that was with him on his second missionary journey. Over the course of that trip, we've seen him pass through the cities and regions that we know from his epistles. We've seen him go through Galatia, southern Turkey, and Philippi, and Thessalonica. Well, in chapter 18, Luke describes two more cities that will be known for Pauline epistles, and that's Corinth and Ephesus. And even in some sense, perhaps by proxy, the first seeds to the epistle to the church at Rome. And we'll see that in a minute. So this morning, our subject will be Paul at Corinth. And so you remember where we've been, that Paul and Silas and Timothy had been traveling across what is modern-day Greece, Macedonia. And their first stop on the road had been in the city of Philippi. There the Lord converted Lydia. Lydia would become instrumental in establishing the Philippian church, also instrumental in the support of the Apostle Paul. But, of course, we saw in Philippi, Paul and Silas were beaten up. They were thrown into jail, and despite them gaining the upper hand on the authorities, they did agree to move on. So they continued to travel west, and they came to the capital city of Thessalonica. And then Paul resumed his custom of first preaching the gospel in the synagogues. And the text says that he did that for three consecutive Sabbaths, reasoning from the scriptures, placing the prophecies that Christ must suffer alongside the life of Jesus, thereby showing, in the words of the text, that this Jesus whom I proclaim to you is the Christ. And in the end, many believed, to the great consternation of those who did not believe. With the result that the Jews enlisted some of the rabble to incite the people into a mob, and they forced Paul to flee again. In fact, the situation in general throughout the empire had become more dangerous because word had begun to spread. Remember the Jews, and we'll see this again this morning, the Jews had been expelled from Rome itself because of the tumult over Christ. And so Paul and the others were being accused. They were those who turned the world upside down, acting against the decrees of Caesar, saying there's another king, Jesus. So word of this was beginning to filter out, making everything far more dangerous. So in the dead of night, Paul and Silas headed for Berea, leaving Timothy behind to quietly establish the Thessalonians in the doctrines of the faith. And in Berea, the gospel found an eager reception. And Luke's praise of their noble efforts to examine the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. That could have only come from the Apostle Paul, as he's telling Luke later. That's a testimony to the impression that the Bereans made upon the Apostle. But the Jews in Thessalonica eventually discovered where Paul had gone, and so they followed him to Berea, and they repeated their tactics again, until finally Paul's life was threatened to the point he had to be rushed to the sea, placed on a boat, and they took him down near Athens, and there his escort left him, taking back with them a message from Paul that Silas and Timothy should follow him as soon as possible. And that's where we began last week. Now, as Paul waited for Timothy and Silas, he wandered through this marvel, which was the ancient city of Athens. Again, it was already ancient by Paul's day, and it was celebrated throughout the Western world as the cradle of philosophy and art and literature, made famous centuries before with the likes of Pericles and Socrates and Plato. But it was also awash with the worship of gods and goddesses. You recall John Stott's comment that what Paul saw was a city submerged in idols. That's actually kind of the flavor of what Luke says there. It's a very unique word, not used anywhere else in the New Testament. It's not just a city of idols, it's a city that is submerged, immersed in idols. And as we said last time, Paul had seen idolatry his whole life, but he had never seen a city and a people that was virtually engulfed in it. And so Luke writes that Paul was then greatly distressed by what he witnessed. He was provoked to anger. It's the same word that's used for God's own reaction to idolatry. So with this righteous indignation, he began preaching in both the synagogue and in the marketplace day after day. Now, being in Athens, many of those passersby that he is beginning to talk to were themselves philosophers. And Paul clearly had lengthy exchanges with Epicureans and Stoics. Luke names both of those. And we talked about the difference between those two schools. that in very simplistic terms, the Epicureans emphasize chance and escape and pleasure, while the Stoics emphasize fatalism and submission and the endurance of pain. And while the Epicureans saw the gods as being so transcendent that they really weren't even relevant to human life, the gods didn't care about what happened to humanity. The Stoics saw them as so imminent as to pervade everything, as we said, like a good and wise gas that permeated all of the universe. But in hearing Paul preach, some thought he was preaching a new set of gods, a god named Jesus and a goddess named Anastasia, because the word for rebirth, as he's talking about the resurrection, was also the woman's name, Anastasia. And so to some, Paul is now peddling new gods. And that's the very charge that put Socrates to death 450 years earlier. So while the account seems cordial when we read Luke, it's likely that when Paul was taken to the Areopagus, or Mars Hill, it could have easily led to his arrest. The Areopagus was home to the Athenian Senate. It was chartered with protecting the morals and religion and education of the people of Athens. And in fact, it's a wonder that they didn't take offense and arrest him, because although Paul is tactful, his basic claim was that he was there to correct their ignorance. He'd come across a temple with an inscription to the unknown god, this god who is unknown to the Athenians. Well, he says this is the personal creator who, quote, created the universe on one hand but cannot be contained by it on the other. This is Stott speaking. To imprison him in stone temples or localize him in a piece of marble is ludicrous. And not only had God created all that there is, but God, this same God, has ordered its history through providence. We see that in verse 26 of chapter 17, where Paul tells them, "And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods in the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him." And so basically what has happened here is he's addressing this Athenian Senate. The Athenians had acknowledged their own ignorance by having this altar to the unknown god. And then Paul had emphasized their ignorance by showing them the absurdity of idolatry. And then he declared that such ignorance left them culpable for judgment, because the coming of Christ not only assured the salvation of his own, but Christ's coming also assured that judgment was now inevitable, and its magnitude would be greater for having heard the gospel and rejected it. Now, of course, that's what most of the Athenians actually did. They rejected it. In fact, it seems that the Senate thought the idea of resurrection was so absurd that they let Paul go as being harmless. I mean, who would believe such a thing? So we closed last week with a troubled Apostle Paul. And that was partly due to the complexities of divine concurrence. He knew that the Greeks saw the cross as foolishness. And yet God had chosen that the new birth would be accompanied by the very foolishness of preaching. But regardless of who responded and who didn't, what Luke records is that the Apostle Paul always believed that a fully reasoned gospel was the Christian's responsibility. And scholars may debate Paul's strategy in Athens, but in reality, the method had always been the same. Because wherever Luke describes Paul's activity, he describes it in these terms, as having reasoned through it, through the scriptures, explained it, proved it, proclaimed it, persuaded them. As we said last week, God has chosen the foolishness of preaching, but not the preaching of foolishness. And that's an important distinction that we've lost today, I think. And so we now turn to chapter 18. From hence within Paul's letters, it appears that Silas and Timothy soon reached Athens, but that Paul had sent them back again, Silas to Philippi, Timothy back to Thessalonica. Paul always understood that his commission was to make disciples, not simply converts. And so he returned these men to their calling, which you remember he would later tell Titus, this is the calling, the training and appointing of elders in every city. And Timothy had also told him that believers in Thessalonica had begun to face persecution. That, of course, raised Paul's concern even further. And so Paul sends them back. And then Paul left Athens for the city of Corinth on his own. Most commentators agree that Paul arrived both dismayed and yet more determined. Athens had impressed upon him anew how empty the wisdom of the world truly was. And he would later tell the Corinthians that when he came to them, he had been more determined than ever to preach nothing but Christ and Him crucified. And yet Paul is still human, and the response of Athens had to have left him displeased, let's say. As Derek Thomas points out, in Athens, Paul didn't experience any of the violence that he faced elsewhere. But he says the polite amusement that had greeted his witness there was perhaps more difficult to take than violence. Instead of attacking him, they ridiculed him. And that was far more difficult to take. If nothing else, Paul must have wondered at the insanity of mankind. A mankind who could believe that resurrection by an all-powerful God was absurd, but yet the idea that you could create a God with your own hands is perfectly rational. What insanity is that? It's also very probable that the prospect of Paul going to Corinth caused him no little dismay. You remember that Paul had known beforehand that Athens was preoccupied with philosophy and idolatry. And yet when he got there, he was still provoked by it. It was even more than he had imagined. Well, Paul also knew by reputation what Corinth was preoccupied with. That was sex. Everything about the city revolved around sex, prostitution. So Paul was headed into the very heart of sexual corruption and sexual depravity that existed in his day. And let me borrow a little bit of background from our survey class on Corinthians to help understand why that had come to be. You recall from those classes, if you were there, that Corinth was this bridge between two seas. It sat on this very narrow land bridge. And there were several things that made Corinth unique in that day. The city had stood there for 4,000 years. She'd been the center of Greek resistance until the Romans utterly destroyed her to the very foundations in 146 BC, and she lay deserted for a century. But then in 44 BC, Julius Caesar resurrected her as a colony for retired military, just as the Romans would do at Philippi. We talked about that. But what that meant was that the new Corinth was a city without roots. There's no aristocracy there. There's no cultured restraints upon people's behavior. And unlike Philippi, these unrefined soldiers soon came into great wealth. And there's a danger. And what we see is to get from Athens to the rest of the Mediterranean required that you either went through Corinth or you risked a dangerous water journey around this archipelago that is the Greek peninsula. So Corinth became a veritable gateway for trade and commerce. That made Corinth the melting pot. You had ex-military, you had merchant sailors. The commerce there attracted Romans and Greeks and Jews, every other sea-trading people. Thus, Corinth grew rich, but also unrestrained. The two seemed to go hand in hand. And so she attracted almost every vice you could think of. In fact, to be called a Corinthian was synonymous with immorality. The name Corinth became the root for several words referring to sexual behavior. When you were acting the Corinthian, you were engaged in sexual immorality. Part of that was because prostitution in Corinth was, in a sense, institutionalized in religion. The Temple of Aphrodite, which stood on the Acrocorinth, this high plateau that overlooked the city, housed at least 1,000 slave prostitutes, and that ranged from the most expensive sacred priestesses to the common porne, they called them. We get the word pornography from that. The word meant prostitute. Its root meaning is to sell, and they're selling sex. Now, we actually get a sense of what confronted him every single day when he was in Corinth. by seeing what was on his mind when he wrote to the Thessalonians from Corinth. Chapter 4, verse 4, he says, "Abstain from sexual immorality, that each one of you know how to control his own body in holiness and honor, not in the passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God." And that's what he was seeing every day. So clearly it was on his mind as he's in Corinth writing to the Thessalonians. As I pointed out in the survey class, all of this drives home this point, and I'll quote it here again, that in many ways the city of Corinth, Paul knew, was closer to a modern American city than almost any other ancient city. We are Corinth. So for Paul, he left one expression of man's spiritual insanity in Athens and descended into another expression of spiritual insanity in Corinth. And so we begin in chapter 18, verse 1. "After this, Paul left Athens, went to Corinth, and he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. And he went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for they were tent makers by trade." Now, we've mentioned this before, that the contemporary Jewish historian Josephus confirms Luke here, that the emperor Claudius had expelled the Jews from Rome after a series of riots, and he says were instigated over Christus, meaning Christ. And so just as everywhere else the gospel had gone, the synagogues of Rome were in turmoil over the question of Jesus. So after being expelled, this Jewish Christian couple, Aquila and his wife Priscilla, had ended up in Corinth. And so Paul hears of them, and he seeks them out, and they're of the same trade, that of tent makers. Now, in all likelihood, Paul was instead an artisan in all things leather, not just tents. By the first century, nearly all leather workers were known as tent makers. And after an animal skin had been tanned, it was no longer unclean, making it a suitable vocation for a Jew. Well, in the ancient world, when people of the same trade were in the same city, unlike today, they didn't compete against each other. They formed a guild. But since almost all guilds adopted a patron god and then sacrificed to it, Jewish tradesmen were often on their own. So for Paul and Aquila, therefore, the circumstances could not have been better. With setting up a leather shop along this colonnaded marketplace, Paul was able to earn his own keep, something that was important, he felt, to his own ministry, as he himself wrote in his epistles. But then also having a partner, Paul could devote time to preaching. And we can also only imagine the hours that Paul and Aquila and Priscilla spent in theological discussion, sharing stories of the churches. In fact, it's likely that it was his conversations with these two believers that had come from Rome that triggered Paul eventually to write his letter to the church there. Not in this trip, but the next time that he passed through Corinth. And just as background, you remember the church at Rome began with people returning from Pentecost. No apostle had been there. And so its instruction concerning Christ would have been very simple, sufficient for the gospel, but lacking depth. And now the Jewish Christians had been forced out for a time, leaving only Gentiles, so the situation was even worse. We can only imagine Priscilla and Aquila there being taught by Paul and then asking him, "You need to write this down and send it to that church in Rome." And of course he would do that, but only after Aquila and Priscilla themselves had returned to Rome. In any case, we see in verse 4 that again Paul does, which was his custom, he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and tried to persuade Jews and Greeks. Now, as we said, Corinth had a history as a Roman colony, but by the first century the city was far too cosmopolitan to live under the restrictions we saw at Philippi, where you couldn't have these foreign, you know, synagogues or foreign gods. You could in Corinth. So there's actually many religions in the city, including a synagogue. We know it was located near the marketplace. And so as he did in every other city, the synagogue was where Paul preached first. And again, we see the tenor of Luke's words emphasizing rational doctrinal persuasion. And we talked about the complexity of salvation in light of concurrence, in that God could save without the gospel. He doesn't need the gospel to regenerate hearts. He doesn't need our understanding to regenerate hearts. He doesn't even need faith to regenerate hearts. But he has chosen to bind our being saved to these very human things. Therefore, Paul presents a lucid, cogent gospel grounded in doctrine. And he tries to persuade his listeners. And it's because of election that in some the scales fall from their eyes and they are persuaded. And who are they? Those are the ones ordained to eternal life, right? They then believe. And so as J.I. Packer famously wrote, it's sovereign election that actually ensures that this persuasion can be fruitful. And so I have this rather lengthy quote from him, but it's very good. He says, "So far from making evangelism pointless, the sovereignty of God and grace is the one thing that prevents evangelism from being pointless. For it creates the possibility, indeed the certainty, that evangelism will be fruitful. Apart from it, there's not even the possibility of evangelism being fruitful. Were it not for the sovereign grace of God, evangelism would be the most futile and useless enterprise that the world has ever seen. And there would be no more complete waste of time under the sun than to preach the Christian gospel without sovereign election." Verse 5. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word, testifying to the Jews that the Christ was Jesus. And when they opposed and reviled him, he shook out his garments and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on I will go to the Gentiles." Of course, this too followed the pattern of Paul's preaching, that regardless of the initial success that he had in the synagogues, eventually the hardened Jews would bar him from preaching there. And notice that although Paul explicitly wrote in Romans that God had blinded the Jews, the guilt still remained theirs. Because the means of their being blinded is their own depravity. And so Paul says, "Your blood is on your own heads, and I will go to the Gentiles." Now you remember we just said that Paul had sent Timothy back to Thessalonica, partly because the city was still in turmoil over the gospel. Persecutions had begun, so clearly for Paul, would the believers persevere? Well, word was brought back by Timothy that indeed the church remained, that she had endured, although not without some unique difficulties. And so Paul is overjoyed by this news, and the three of them, it's actually written in their three names, wrote to the Thessalonians from Corinth, that among other things, a convert to Christ must expect tribulation in this life. And also that they hadn't missed the resurrection, as some were claiming. He reminded them from Corinth that he had told them at the time this was coming. He tells them, speaking of afflictions, he says in chapter 3, "For you yourselves know that we are destined for this. We kept telling you beforehand that we were to suffer, just as it has come to pass." But in the meantime, Paul, now having been thrown out of the synagogue, he's pretty cheeky. He opens what is basically a seminary in the house next door. Verse 7. "And he left there and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of God, and his house was next door to the synagogue. Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord, together with his entire household. And many of the Corinthians hearing Paul believed and were baptized." And referring back to these events, Paul later wrote to the Corinthians that he had planted, Apollos had watered. Well, remarkably, among the seeds planted that grew to faith was this ruler of the synagogue and his entire family. We also see that Titius Justus may have had the first name of Gaius. And if so, then these are the two men that Paul is referring to in that letter that he baptized in Corinth himself. We see that in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, where he says, I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius. Well, we can only imagine then the outcry among the Jews to have the ruler of the synagogue converted to what they considered this cult of Jesus, and then to have their house church located next door. So tensions were terribly high once again. And Paul had seen this play out in other cities. The mob violence, the riots, the attempts on his life. Those thoughts must have been on Paul's mind, must have been in his prayers, because Luke records that the Lord's answer to those prayers comes in verse 9. And he says, And the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, Do not be afraid, but go on speaking and do not be silent, for I am with you, and no one will attack you to harm you, for I have many in the city who are my people. And he stayed a year and 6 months teaching the word of God among them. And so in light of his recent history, Paul must have expected he was going to be forced to flee again, or to be beaten, or to be imprisoned, or even to lay down his life. But the Lord assures him of his safety in this time. And more profound still was that the Lord assured Paul that he had many in the city who belonged to God. He says, I have many in the city who are my people. Well, these are people who have not yet heard the gospel, and yet their future salvation is assured. God knows it. The Lord promised here that there would be fruit to Paul's preaching in Corinth because God had a people elected to hear him and elected to believe it. And yet history still unfolds with a certain predictability, because as fallen creatures we are pretty predictable. Namely, that fallen men must rage against the Lord's anointed. And so the Lord's promise was to protect Paul, not to lessen the Jews' hatred. And so the Jews did make an attempt against him. Beginning in verse 12. It says, But when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him before the tribunal, saying, This man is persuading people to worship God contrary to the law. And so once again, Paul is forcibly brought before the local authorities. In this case, he was taken to the agora, brought before the Bema seat, which is this raised platform from which judgments were passed and awards were given. There he was charged again with a crime of religion. In this case, not the preaching of new gods, and the Jews actually make a mistake here. The Jews attempt to draw a distinction between Judaism and the new faith. If the judge had agreed to that, then Paul would have lost the protection that Judaism afforded him. Judaism was considered grudgingly by Rome to be a legal religion because of its long ancient history. And to this point, the Roman authorities made no distinction between Judaism and Christianity. Therefore, ironically, during the church's infancy, it was the Romans and the Roman law that protected her from the Jews. Well, in this case, and in most cases, we also see that God's restraint of the wicked included the use of fallen human behavior. Verse 14. But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, If it were a matter of wrongdoing or vicious crime, O Jews, I would have reason to accept your complaint. But since it is a matter of questions about words and names and your own law, see to it yourselves. I refuse to be a judge of these things. And he drove them from the tribunal. And they all seized Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him in front of the tribunal. But Gallio paid no attention to any of this. And so this attempt backfired against the Jews, because primarily the charge they brought was too specifically Jewish, that God, the Hebrew God, was being falsely worshipped. Gallio didn't care about that. Now, Gallio was proconsul for 2 years beginning in July of 51 AD. So we have this time marker, and that's convenient. He's also the brother of Seneca, who was Nero's tutor. Nero would have both of them killed. But while Gallio's verdict was reasonable in this context, the portrait of the man here is not flattering. He refused to allow Paul to speak. He addressed the Jewish accusers with derision. He had them physically driven away. He refused to intervene when the mob began to beat Sosthenes, the man who had replaced Crispus as ruler of the synagogue. And all I'm saying here is the bottom line is that in God's hands, Gallio's prejudicial dislike of the Jews is instrumental in protecting Paul. It's a means of God fulfilling his promise that Paul would not be attacked, at least here, at least for a time. And so Gallio summarily dismissed the charges, even without a full hearing. And if the book of Acts actually was a legal brief, remember we talked about that possibility back in the very first lesson, then Gallio's ruling here would have been a powerful precedence. So Roman authorities already said, throw out charges here, that this there's nothing illegal about this. Now the question of why Sosthenes was beaten is hard to understand. Was this a mob of non-Jews doing the beating, or had the Jews beaten their own for such a spectacular failure? Regardless, the more intriguing aspect is that we see the greeting in Paul's first letter to the Corinthians when he calls Sosthenes a brother. And this brother was actually with him at the time of the writing. So it's possible, if not probable, that in Corinth, two successive synagogue presidents were converted to Christ. And so the Jews must have been beside themselves. And yet, just as the Lord promised, Paul remained safe. And after 18 months, he left without incident, leaving behind a thriving, if not also vexing, body of believers. Verse 18. After this, Paul stayed many days longer and then took leave of the brothers and set sail for Syria, and with him Priscilla and Aquila. At Cenchrea, I don't know how you pronounce that to be honest, he had cut his hair, for he was under a vow. And so here Paul leaves for Syria, taking with him his fellow believing tent makers, Priscilla and Aquila. And Luke records almost as an aside that Paul cut his hair when he reached this city where he would depart for home. This city that I can't pronounce is actually pretty much the departure point for ships coming to and from, eventually going into Corinth. And so he reaches this city, and he says he's been under a vow, and so he cuts his hair. Well, this shows that Paul had not abandoned his Jewish heritage, for one thing. He was practicing in private aspects that would have been foreign to the Gentiles that he were constantly preaching to. But during the period of such a vow, Paul would have let his hair grow uncut. When he did cut his hair, it would have marked the end of the vow. And while we cannot know for certain, the vow and its ending was likely this expression of gratitude and thankfulness to God for having brought him safely through Macedonia and Corinth as God had promised him. You have kept me safe. And he cuts his hair. He had not been cutting his hair as kind of a vow to the Lord. And now in gratitude for having brought him safely through it, he then cuts his hair and the vow has ended. Then in verse 19, and they came to Ephesus, and he left them there, but he himself went into the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. When they asked him to stay for a longer period, he declined. But on taking leave of them, he said, I will return to you if God wills. And he set sail from Ephesus. And so Ephesus, back in Asia Minor, had this large Jewish population. But at this moment, Paul was essentially only passing through on his way back to Antioch. It says in verse 22, when he landed at Caesarea, he went up and greeted the church and then went down to Antioch. After spending some time there, he departed and went from one place to the next throughout the region of Galatia and Phrygia, strengthening all the disciples. And so with the winds, it was easier to land at Caesarea than Antioch. It also allows him to see the churches there. And so the second missionary journey had ended. 3,000 miles over land and sea, and the founding of so many of the churches of Paul's epistles. So we have this protracted miracle of God's providence in bringing and spreading the gospel into the ancient Greek world.